Major Han, Real 28. You were saying that you got an idea of where the enemy were most likely to oppose you again from sit traps, and you mentioned air sit traps.
Yes. You'd get those two occasionally. You'd get a sit trap, and then you'd get an air sit trap, you know, which would say, oh, concentration of so and so there, or, you know, build up there. It's more further back. Oh, they'd spotted 200 tanks or so many tanks from the air.
Did you know where those air sit reps came from, by what route they got down to you?
Well, I suppose from the liaison in a divisional headquarters or corps headquarters from the Desert Air Force, and then that had come down through the normal chain of command. I didn't get them very often. You know, well, we didn't see them very often. They probably were sent to where it mattered. But occasionally we'd get them down through to squadron headquarters.
You had no direct contact with the Air Force?
Oh, no. No, it wasn't the time like we had in Italy later, where you could sort of be on the radio to them. There was none of that sort of close cooperation then. I hadn't sort of come in. That would have helped if we could have done, in lots of cases.
Direct liaison is always much quicker, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. If there's something up, you know, they used to have some flying around upside in Italy, where you could then sort of switch on and say, yeah, something so-and-so, and get them in.
But not when you're in Cyrenaica or
nowhere on the desert, and that wasn't until much later on the desert in Italy. So anyway, where we were up in Barchi, and then we went on from there. And by then, I think there was contact being made beyond Barchi with the enemy. Because on one afternoon, it was quite late, we got nine German soldiers were caught by one of our troops and brought back to squadron headquarters for the night. And of course, we had to look after them. And of course, it was it's the thing we never wanted, to have nine or any enemy with us at night. But that meant you had to guard them, and out in the desert anywhere, you know, it was not so easy. And I know these nine arrived, and I think we didn't have many armoured cars there. I think there was only probably three of us. And,
three armoured cars?
Three armoured cars there.
At squadron headquarters?
Yes, and the transport lorry. So I was sort of, it was my responsibility to make sure these prisoners were safe for the night. So I thought, oh, well. So I hit on an idea. I got one of the tarpaulins, which we used to use the bivvy, you know, at night as a rule. They were sort of rubberized things. So I laid it out on the ground and got the nine soldiers to lay down on the bivvy with their heads at one, all at one end. And then I pulled the... got the thing pulled over them with their heads just showing, and then sort of staked the bivvy to the ground so they couldn't get out that way. The only way they could get out was from the top, where you could see the heads, you see, and say, right, that's where you are for the night. And it all only then needed one man to be on guard to just to watch that they didn't get out. That's a simple way of doing it, usually.
So it's like having the children tucked up in bed.
That's right. And you knew they couldn't get out anywhere, and that saved on manpower. And of course, at that time, you know, sleep was important. Because you were, you know, the dawn was early and late night. And people, when they've been on patrol or working or whatever, they want a good night's sleep. So that's what we did. And while I was getting this organised, my driver and gunner, that was Paddy Doran and Joe Shaw. Paddy was an Irishman, great character, lovely man. And Joe Shaw was a Midlanders. And they were putting up a one-man bivvy for me to sleep in that night, you see. So when I got this all organised, and I thought, right, now I'll get into bed. So I got into my bivvy, and I had my bed rest. I had a bed roll, or blankets, and I made a pillow with my battle dress blouse, with my pistol underneath there, and my boots, desert boots under that, you know, and sort of got in there, out of me for the night. I thought this was wonderful. And then, sometime during the night, I heard a pitter-patter of rain. And I don't know if you're the same, but when you're in a tent, and you're snug, you're warm, you hear this pitter-patter of rain, and you feel even more snug. Have you experienced? Do you experience that?
Makes it more, even more comforting.
That's right. And this was fantastic. That really was rainy coming here. And I thought, my word, this is great. And after a while, I sort of turned over and thought, oh, this is good. And as I turned over, a tidal wave of water washed straight over me. And the only thing that had been keeping it back was my pillow.
Ah.
And, you know, that was behind. And as I turned, it allowed it to come all over me. And I was absolutely soaked. And, of course, then I started to shiver. It was really cold then, because it was in the desert night. Mm. And what had happened, I know it wasn't done deliberately, my bivvy had been put out in a slight gully to give me a little bit more thing. And of course the water was coming down and built up.
Channeled into it. Mm-hmm.
And it built up there. And as I turned, it came over. It was a miserable night. I got in the armour car and got the number 2 cooker and got that pumping to try to give me a bit of warmth, you know, because I had nothing else really to change into. You know, and then the next day was a dull, damp day, and of course I couldn't get the blankets dried, and so it's pretty miserable.
How George Ehrman's done?
Oh, they're all right. Only their heads got wet, but at least they were undercover. There was no problem with them.
Had any of them attempted to escape or misbehave?
Well, they couldn't get out anyway, and with the guard there, there was no problem.
What sort of Germans were they? Did you know what sort of soldiers they were?
They were infantry. I remember their uniforms were very light, rather the colour your light khaki.
Sort of light stone colour.
Mm. Mm. And they seemed all sort of smart. Well, I say they were of a good infantry regiment.
How did you communicate with them?
Well, mostly they could understand you. With it. A lot of them could speak English anyway. Mm. And you could put things over.
Did you feed them?
Oh, yes. Always. Well, with what rations we had. We had to share our own rations with them, but we always gave them what we could. And
were they carrying anything other than their clothes? And
nothing else. Nothing else. I think when they'd been caught, they might have been in the truck or something. I know they'd been caught by one of the forward troops, one of the other troops. And so they'd taken everything off their arms and things, you know. And they just had what they stood up in.
What happened to them?
So then, the next morning, we could send them back under escort to RHQ, who would have a set-up interrogation unit or get somebody who could interrogate them and then pass further back. Mm.
How did you get them back? Did you send them back in the truck? Or?
On the truck, with an escort, yeah. Mm. But, I mean, we might have had a one-tonner there. So you would cram the 9 of them in.
It'd be a bit of a tight squeeze, wouldn't it, for a one ton?
Yeah, but there it is. You know, 4 down each side and 3 sitting on the floor in the middle.
Mm.
Something like that. But, I mean, a laboratory tour. But we all treated them well. You know, there was no, don't know any of the in the regiment who treated a prisoner badly. You know, once they were that, they were treated with more courtesy, really. There was never, I don't think, any bad feeling, you know, to take it out on them. And they were good soldiers. We respected them as an enemy and treated them as such, you know, when they were taken prisoner.
Did they show respect for you?
Oh, yes, they were quite courteous. And I know some of them, one or two of the officers that we had, would say we should be fighting with them, not against us. Against the Russians, that's who they... And that was one of the things they always used to, you know, say when they were taken prisoner.
Did that have any sort of impact on you or your soldiers or when
really,
they said that?
Not really, no. I mean, as far as we were concerned, they were the enemy. And I don't think we were never brainwashed. I mean, we never got lectures on politics or anything like that. Our job, we were soldiers, we were fighting the enemy, and that's it. And there was no case of why we should be fighting against Russia or anything like that. So I don't think we had, as it got later, I think, where people started to question politics.
Well, did anyone question whether you should be fighting the Germans, or was there any propaganda about that,
not
if you remember?
Really. No, nobody ever questioned why we should be fighting. It was a case that, you know, that's our job. We're fighting. I mean, really, I think if lots more people had a question, I mean, like, if they had a question in the First World War when you saw the slaughter there, that was the time when they should have questioned. But we didn't see any film or anything about the First World War, you know, which would have brought it home to us what a complete waste it was. I mean, I think all that was hushed up pretty well. And it wasn't until after the Second World War we started to see the pictures and the terrible waste of the First World War, which you see a lot of now, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly do.
You know, and I mean, I think had we have seen that, I think people might have questioned, well, what for? But I don't think there was the same slaughter in the Second World War as there was in the First. In trenches and terrible...
But I mean, this is a different question about who you're fighting, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, really, we didn't have a great reason for fighting anyway, I don't think, because all it was the occupation of Poland, wasn't it?
Initially.
We didn't know about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And which would have probably given us a greater incentive to end the war. You know, all we knew that it was the Poles who were invaded, and we had a pact with the Poles that should they be invaded, we would, you know. So it was occupation of land, really, wasn't it, which the reason to go to war. And nowadays, people think, well, is that really a cause for war? Mm. Although we did it in the Falklands, that was occupation of land again.
And the Gulf War as well.
And the Gulf War, yes.
But, there are other things connected with it, such as the bad faith of the Germans in breaking promises
That's
and breaking
right.
treaties.
That's right,
But, it does seem what you're saying is though in the 12th Lancers, it was not the thing to do, to think about the reasons for the war, and who you were fighting. You were just getting on with it because you were a soldier.
That's right, and that was your duty. you're a soldier for your country, and your country has said, right, we're at war, and therefore you fight to defend your country. I think, really. No, there was never any question of, you know, what am I doing here? Very few. Certainly everyone who was up in the front line with you, they were there because they were good soldiers.
Well, the answer then would have been you're here because you volunteered.
That's right. Yeah.
You took the shilling.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think I only ever saw one man who got out of going to the front line. And as I told you earlier, when we were in, before we went out to the desert, he was a corporal. And he had some skin rash on his legs. And he was determined he wasn't going to the desert. And I saw him one day with a tin of Bluebell, you know, polish, metal polish, rubbing it on his legs in order to make it worse.
Self-inflicted wound?
Yeah. Now, I could have reported him, but I thought, no, that sort of man, you don't want to come out there with you because somebody's life will depend on him, and he's the sort of man who you couldn't...
you wouldn't trust him.
...wouldn't rely on. Mm. And he never came out. He was sick, and off he went back, and he never came to out with us on the boat. But that sort of man, you don't want. Mm. He's better out of it. Mm. He could probably lose you more. Could lose you 20 year friends, that sort of person. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, everybody was there, and they were never heard anyone sort of moan really about. You had always the moan of roll on when I could get home and be there when this is all over, that sort of thing. But you never had any dissident talk at all.
And your chaps were not influenced at all by what the Germans said to them?
No. As you say, we were there to do a job. And I think had we known more about the concentration camps, it might have given us another completely different outlook, because it wasn't until much later we learned about the concentration camps.
Well, it would probably have provided a stronger motive for doing the duty and doing it.
I mean, to get it over quicker. Mm. Well, none of us could have got it over quicker than what we really wanted. Mm. So, that was our little bit of swimming in a good way. Before we reached Benghazi, we were withdrawn.
How close did you get, do you think, before you were? How close were you before you were when you were withdrawn?
I'm not sure, to be quite honest. I mean, we were approaching it, and the forward elements would have reached it in a fair time, but we didn't actually go into Benghazi. And we were withdrawn to a place called Tamimi, and that was not far from the coast. And we'd been there before, you know, in earlier trips on the way up the first time. And it was a pretty bleak area. Sand, gravel, flat area, and a long way from any sort of civilization. Here, they set up a central cookhouse so that the armored cars were scattered all around, and one central cookhouse was put up in the middle so that we didn't have to do our own individual cooking on armored cars, which made it good. because you've got sort of a squadron cook who was then serve up the usual sort of stews and hot sweet tea and things like that, which made a change.
So you've got the whole regiment concentrated.
Well, no, I don't think the whole regiment then, that was just the squadron.
Oh, just the squadron went back into...
Tamimi.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you've got squadron in reserve at Tamimi.
Yeah, but the other squadrons, they came back a bit later, but they weren't... Each squadron had its own area, and there'd be another squadron some distance away. Mm. But I think then we were all withdrawn, you know, to give us a break.
So this was the first rest since the Alamein breakout.
Yeah.
How long had you been going then? Because you came out of Alamein in the end of October, didn't you?
That's right. Yeah. No. What day? I'll try to find a date for you. Should have a date somewhere. I don't know what month I'm in at the moment. Oh, January.
January, so you've been going November, December,
yeah.
So at least 2 months.
Yeah. So it was, that's right, it was January, 10th of January. When we, after Tamimi, we went back on the 10th of January, so we've been about 2 months like that.
What were you doing while you were in Tamimi?
Well, it was a matter of sort of doing maintenance, really, and sort of getting ourselves tidied up. And we had Christmas dinner there, and I've got a menu of it, actually. And we had turkey, roast beef, pork, roast potatoes, cauliflowers, peas, plum pudding, rum sauce, mince pies, fruit, nuts, beer, cigars, and all that was sent, you know, which was quite a change from...
Sounds like a real feast.
It was a real Christmas dinner, you know, which had been sort of, the quartermaster had been back and got everything, and I think the Queen, Mum, always used to send out Christmas puddings for the regiment. I don't know why it still happens, I know she used to. And that might well have been some of the Christmas puddings that found its way to it, I'm not certain. Mm. But they said she always does. And while we were there, General Horrocks, who was the Corps Commander.
30 Corps later on, wasn't he?
Pardon?
Commander of 30 Corps.
Yes, yeah. He came, paid a visit to the regiment, and we all had to go on parade. And the whole regiment paraded, you know, in straight lines, and he came and he visited and he inspected us all. We were all in our best kit, because we used to carry a certain amount of kit in our own cars, so we all had to get in, you know, boots, gaiters, and sort of really smart. And he came along and inspected, and he was very pleased actually with the turnout, except with the officers.
What was wrong with the officers?
Well, it's funny, there was all the soldiers all dressed up, you know, with the equipment blanketed, and really like a peacetime parade. And of course the officers turned up in corduroys, side hats or peak caps, silk scarves, just like they do when they're in the armoured cars, you know. Mm-hmm. All different variety of dress, and suede shoes, and they all in front, you know, the soldiers. And he dismissed the soldiers, and he certainly went to town on the officers. He made them parade separately about 3 or 4 days later, in best battle dress, boots, gaiters, and everything. And of course, those all the elves were chasing around, borrowing boots, gaiters, webbing equipment, you know, and that off the soldiers in order to get on parade. and how it really stated them, you know, which was, I think, wrong in a way, because they're all good officers, you know, and they've done their job really well. But they didn't turn up on parade as Horace expected. So I always remember that, the panic to get some decent equipment for the horses to wear.
What had happened to their equipment, their clothing? Well, they just lost it?
They all had separate, you know, they had, some of them had the battle dress made for themselves, you know, like of same as the service dress material.
Yes.
And they never wore boots, never saw an officer in boots, or gaiters, or anything like that. It's all suede shoes and that sort of thing. A brown boot, a brown shoes, when they wore their service dress, but they didn't have their service dress in their armoured cars, sand browns or things like that. But when they're on the desert, they'd have corduroys, suede shoes, a service dress type shirt, you know, with the light material, probably a pullover and a silk scarf. Probably a service dress hat or a red side hat, you know, and that was their dress on the desert, you know, and that was acceptable until Horrocks wanted them on parade.
What happened after this famous parade? Did they revert to their usual habits?
Oh, absolutely. They borrowed the kit to suit Horrocks for the parade, and that was they were back to as well. As all the cavalry regiments used to be like that, you know, you never saw a cavalry officer in an armoured car, all dressed up using the various dress. Nobody ever queried it. I don't know if the tank corps used to be the same, but certainly the cavalry used to be that sort of.
You didn't normally wear boots and gaiters and so on, did you, when you were operating?
No. You'd wear a pair of white slacks like this. Mm. I also wear a pair of slacks like this. Desert boots. A khaki Acadie shirt, light shirt. A pistol belt. And a side hat. And that was always my dress. And most of the soldiers the same. You know, it was that's all you wanted, and probably have a cardigan or, you know, a pullover for when it's cold at night. So, or you'd wear, some of them used to wear shorts and sort of the long stocking things, whichever was most comfortable, really. Anyway, we stayed in that area for a while, and then by then we had made up any equipment we'd lost, you know, so we were then completely back to full strength again.
What sort of work did you have to do on your car then while you were having this period of maintenance? What were the urgent things?
Well, if you could, you change oils, do the greasing, sort of, if you could, take the starter motor off, clean it, you clean your guns, strip them right down, give them the, you know, everything that, in that respect, you'd do. I mean, there was no set, say you'd work from 9 till 12 or that, you'd do as you wanted. Things were pretty leisurely, as long as your vehicle was in good state, then you played according to what was needed. After that, then you'd sort of read a book or something. You know, there was nothing else to do unless there was any particular new thing that you had to be taught. You know, if there was, say, a new type of gun came out or something,